Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, and I host All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. It's a show where we investigate why people behave the way they do. But there's some perspectives we don't often hear about, like what makes people cross the line into criminal behavior?
Are they evil or are they damaged? Are they both?
Join me for Criminal Psychology, a special series diving into some of these questions. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
He abandoned his wife and kids, cut contact with his parents, and allegedly hid in India for 4 years. Now, accused killer Rajwinder Singh has watched his family give evidence in his murder trial. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Welcome to the case of Toya's murder. And just a content warning for this episode, towards the end, we'll be discussing the injuries that Toya sustained.
The body of Toya Cordingley was found at Wongeti Beach, north of Cairns.
Her face adorns billboards and stickers across the region.
Searching for clues in the murder of the 24-year-old pharmacy worker.
Alongside the idyllic and isolated beaches.
This should not happen to a young woman out there walking her dog on a Sunday.
The third week of this trial has started. The friends and family of Rajwinder Singh have been in court. And Chris Dester from ABC Far North has been there as well. Hey, Chris.
G'day, Stocky.
Can you give us a wrap of the last couple of days in 60 seconds or so?
Well, for the first time in this trial, we've really heard evidence about Rajwinder Singh, the man, who he is, the nature of his relationships with his family, because his wife, his parents and his sister have actually come to court and given evidence about the day that he left Australia. And we've heard a little bit about his movements on that day that Ms. Cordingley was allegedly murdered. We've also heard evidence about how he came to the police's attention about 3 weeks into their investigation as they tracked the movements of his blue Alfa Romeo car that day and triangulated them against phone pings from Toya Cordingley's handset.
Thank you, Chris. The strategy around the phone pings and this CCTV is something I'm really looking forward to talking a bit about in this episode, because it gives us a real insight into, I think, the kind of the weight of that evidence, how big a part of the case that is, not so much in the way the prosecution's doing it, but certainly in the way that the defence is approaching that. Before we get there, though, as you say, like, we've learnt so much more about Rajwinder Singh in the last couple of days, his home life and his work life. And I think the witness who has stuck with me the most is his wife, Sukhdeep Kaur, describing him on the day of Toya's murder and then how he basically kind of disappeared the following day, the day that Toya's body was found. What stood out to you from her evidence?
Well, we went right back, I guess, to their first meeting, which was actually back in India. They moved to Australia in 2009. It was actually the same year that they got married in India. And it was put to the court that it was an arranged marriage. So they've moved to Australia. Sukhdeep Kaur arrived speaking very little English. And we've just heard about this dynamic. You know, they lived in Innisfail. It was a rural part of Far North Queensland. He was initially studying horticulture. She was packing bananas. He's obviously eventually studied and found work as a nurse. And we've heard a bit about their relationship, you know, potentially some issues between the two of them in the lead up to this happening in 2018. And then the circumstances on that, as you say, on the 22nd of October, he essentially just left. He said he was going somewhere for a couple of days, told her that she and the kids couldn't come. They were on school holidays at the time. And essentially, he never returned back to the family home.
Yeah. I think, the description that stuck with me was, you know, when did you next see him? And she's like, in a courtroom, which was kind of wild. And I mean, him leaving seems like it's caused a bit of tension and a bit of stress. It sounds like he was like the breadwinner in the house. And am I right in saying and thinking that, you know, the bank took the house not long after he left?
Yeah, there were a lot of questions from the prosecution asked of Sukhdeep Kaur about, you know, how she paid for things. She said she had access to a savings card, but after Rajwinder Singh left, and we've since heard about the circumstances in which he quit his job at the Innisfail Hospital, the bank repossessed the house. And remember, this was a house that they lived not only with their three children, but also Rajwinder Singh's parents would be there the times that they were in Australia. And they were in Australia this weekend, the 21st of October 2018.
Mm, yeah, we heard about Rajwinder Singh taking his dad to the Sikh temple on the Sunday morning, the day that Toya was murdered. And then we also, you know, we'll get to this a little bit later, we see some of the movements around him that day as well. But I mean, Chris, the thing I found really interesting was the way that, you know, these witnesses were questioned. You talked about the way the prosecution has questioned Sukhdeep Kaur. The defence went a really different way and kind of lent into a bit more of that, you know, the tension in the relationship you described as well.
That's right. We heard evidence from Sukhdeep Kaur, and it really came out through cross-examination from Kate Juhas, who's one of Rajwinder Singh's barristers, that there were actually tensions in their relationship. He had told her in the months leading up to him leaving Australia that he wanted a divorce. At one point, he'd actually gone to his cousin's house for about 7 to 10 days, and Sukhdeep Kaur described, you know, going there, and, you know, he eventually agreed to come home. And Kate Juhas asked Sukhdeep Kaur about whether she was concerned about him wanting a divorce because of the shame it would bring on their families, and she agreed with that proposition. She said she was very concerned about that, you know, that the marriage would end in divorce and that it would bring shame on their families.
Yeah, right. What were the looks between, you know, Sukhdeep Kaur and Rajwinder Singh like in that room? I mean, I'm back in Melbourne now, so we don't have a link of the room. I can't see any of that detail. Can you describe that for me? Take me there.
It was really interesting, and of course, in a courtroom, there are a lot of different moving parts and a lot of people talking at different times, so it's hard to keep your eyes fixed on one person, but I was trying to catch, you know, whether they would, you know, sustained eye contact with one another, and they certainly looked at one another, but it appeared, at least if they did kind of lock eyes and stare at each other, you know, look directly at each other for a prolonged period of time, it might have just been fleeting moments. Mostly they were, you know, Sukhdeep Kaur was looking ahead at the jury or the judge, and Rajwinder Singh would look down often when she turned to his direction. So quite interesting dynamic between them in that courtroom.
Yeah, the dynamics of this and the of Rajwinder Singh's family are something I'm really interested in, because we also heard from his mum, his dad and his sister, and the relationship he's had with them seems a little bit different. You know, we heard them talking about how they've actually spoken to him since he's come back to Australia, you know, kind of a few times a week. But also, you know, they did appear to kind of actually start looking for him at one point as well. You know, we heard previously that, you know, the family reported Rajwinder Singh missing after he didn't return home after a couple of days. But it sounds like his dad's also kind of gone out of his way on a trip to India to try and figure out where he's gone, right?
Yeah, and the sister mentioned, his sister Palwinder Kaur mentioned having gone there as well. And the court was actually played an audio recording of Rajwinder Singh on the 22nd of October booking his flight from Cairns to India, to New Delhi. And he's told the operator on the phone that his grandfather was very sick and he just wanted a one-way ticket. You know, there was a bit of discussion about, you know, the different route options, you know, whether he could travel via Sydney or Melbourne or other places like Kuala Lumpur or Singapore.
Yeah, right.
But one of the questions that was asked of both their parents was, you know, about their fathers, being Rajwinder Singh's two grandfathers. And we heard one was deceased and the other was unwell. But when they've gone to the home village in the Punjab region of Butta Kalan and spoken to aunts and uncles there, the court heard that no one seemed to know where Rajwinder Singh was. So any attempts to find him were unsuccessful, and all of his family gave evidence that those years he was away from October 2018 until early in 2023 when he was extradited back to Australia, they didn't know where he was and they didn't speak to him at all during that time.
Yeah. What do we know about the relationship between Sukhdeep Kaur and Rajwinder Singh's parents now? What's that like?
Well, this is interesting because we heard it was an arranged marriage, that she was worried that if he wanted a divorce and they got one, that it would bring shame on their families. Sukhdeep Kaur actually told the court that to this day, his parents love her very, very much, and she described them as having been supportive of her during this time. We didn't hear any evidence about exactly where they're all living at the moment. But interestingly, yeah, to this day, she seems quite fond of Rajwinder Singh's mum and dad, who spent a lot of time with them. You know, we heard that when their first child was born, Rajwinder Singh's mum actually came to Australia and took care of that daughter for quite a while.
Hmm. It's such an interesting insight we get into people's lives through cases like this. So, Chris, thanks for kind of giving us that insight and taking us there. Chris, something else that we've seen over the last few days are Rajwinder Singh's movements the day that Toya Cordingley was murdered. So, I mean, we saw CCTV during the openings at the start of this trial of Toya Cordingley's movements around this time. And now we've seen this vision of Rajwinder Singh moving around, you know, prior to, you know, allegedly being at Wangetti Beach on this day. And, I mean, what stuck out to you? We've seen kind of what he's wearing, what he's doing, you know, is this, all these places, are they all kind of familiar to you, someone who lives in Cairns?
Absolutely. And I think it's quite interesting. He lived, of course, in Innisfail. So that's where he started his day on the 21st of October 2018. And then travelling north towards Cairns on the Bruce Highway. He then went to Cairns Central Shopping Centre before heading north. And I think, of course, you remember his journey back south and the stop at Caravonica. Almost no part of Cairns was left kind of untouched by Rajwinder Singh's journey that day, from what we've seen in the CCTV that's played to the court. And for a lot of people, you know, sitting down, kind of wandering slowly around Cairns Central Shopping Centre and sitting down at the food court for a meal might be a thing that a lot of people do. And that's actually what Rajwinder Singh did that day. He got to the shopping centre about midday, having dropped off his father at the Sikh temple in Innisfail a little earlier. And the cameras kind of, they were able to just follow his movements. And kind of we watched this sped up vision of him sitting down at the food court having a meal before the blue Alfa Romeo was then seen heading north on the Captain Cook Highway towards the Northern Beaches and, of course, where Wangetti Beach is on the way to Port Douglas.
It all seems and sounds so normal.
Yeah, it's we heard at the outset of the case in the Crown opening that Toya Cordingley was just doing what she did on that day. You know, she took her dog to the beach for a walk, and from what we've seen on the CCTV, at least for the morning and early afternoon, there didn't appear to be anything overly unusual about Rajwinder Singh's movements either. Mm-hmm. Where things got a little bit more strange, according to the Crown case, is Rajwinder Singh's journey back to Innisfail later that evening.
Yeah, and this is really interesting because this is where we finished our last episode. You know, this is not just CCTV and traffic camera footage. It's also the phone pings of Toya Cordingley's phone. And a really key part of the prosecution's case is linking Rajwinder Singh to Toya Cordingley's phone. And they do that through a couple of ways. So they basically are tracking the phone pings of Toya Cordingley's phones. They know roughly where that is at a series of times. And then they use that to kind of figure out what cars were passing through those areas at those times. And they set up a bit of a kind of a dragnet basically to identify that. And then to kind of narrow that down, they also use this thing called timing advance, which is the amount of time it takes for the phone to ping basically from the phone to the tower. And it gives kind of a vague distance between that. So it sort of narrows down the area that phone is likely to be in that time. And again, that's something that the prosecution, you know, has used, and we've heard evidence that the police have used to kind of build that net. Chris, something I've noticed though is that, you know, the defense are asking a lot of questions of timing advance. They're really kind of drilling into, you know, what that is, how accurate that is. What are they getting at there?
Well, they're essentially asking questions of witnesses about its accuracy, because the purpose of timing advance is to ensure that the phone network functions properly so that every phone in an area that connects to a tower actually has signal and that they don't interrupt one another. It's not designed specifically for law enforcement, just we've heard evidence about how the police can use it, the data to kind of approximate where a phone would be, by both directionally from a phone tower and also the number of meters away from the tower that it is, because that's the measurement that timing advance is expressed in. And I guess it's really crucial to the Crown case because they've used this data to estimate where Toya Cordingley's handset would have been the three times that it last connected with towers through that kind of northwestern part of Cairns. And that's where they've got this window of time looking at all the traffic movements through there. And we're able to exclude most of the, you know, the 70 cars that passed through the intersection at that time. And the one that came to their attention was this blue Alfa Romeo. They've gone through a list of blue Alfa Romeos registered as being garaged in Queensland. And the one that stood out to police, and this is about 3 weeks into their investigation, so they'd looked at other persons of interest by this time. The courts heard that the one that they kind of zeroed in on was Rajwinder Singh's. It belonged to Rajwinder Singh and was registered to his home in Innisfail. So then they've been able to obtain CCTV footage of that car's movements both earlier in the day, but also later in the day as it was heading back towards Innisfail from northern Cairns in the evening.
Yeah, right. And I mean, Chris, you know, talking timing advance and just kind of coming back to that for a moment, I mean, if that detail is different, I mean, we've heard a bit about how, you know, some things can change, you know, the amount of time it takes for, you know, a ping to bounce there and back. I mean, if that is a different number, I mean, is there potentially more cars that could have fallen into that dragnet?
Well, the detective, Sergeant Matthew Maddock, who was the one tasked with overseeing the collation of this CCTV footage and I guess designing that dragnet, as we're calling it, he told the court that he'd kind of built in an extra allowance and looked at a wider window of time than what he thought was possible. Interestingly, we saw evidence that the police actually drove some of these routes that they estimated the phone would have travelled on, and they did it several times, and then they kind of averaged the time it took them to complete that drive at that time of day. So they kind of did their own experiments, if you will, or test runs to kind of get a bit of an idea of how long it should or normally would take to make that journey, and even like the fastest time that you could possibly do it in. And Matthew Maddock said it appeared that the phone was probably moving at about road speed. So we're not talking any unusual kind of speeds here, that the traffic was all more or less moving per his evidence at kind of what you would expect the speed limit to be.
And Chris, you mentioned Rajwinder Singh's journey home was unusual. What do you mean by that?
Well, we heard evidence about how long it took him to get from Innisfail into Cairns earlier in the morning, and it was a journey of about an hour and 20 minutes, but interestingly, it took him much longer to get back to Innisfail later that evening. So he was picked up on the Gordon Vale camera just after 6 o'clock. That's a traffic camera on the highway south of Cairns. But he didn't get back into Innisfail, we heard, until just before 8 o'clock. And the police gave evidence that he didn't come in on, you know, he wasn't spotted on the camera that they would have expected him to kind of appear on the way back into Innisfail, but actually appeared to have entered town the back way. And then, interestingly enough, there's a traffic camera on a roundabout near Rajwinder Singh's home where you can kind of see where he pulled out earlier in the morning to come out of his own street. But if you head straight on that road, we heard that that road leads to a place called Flying Fish Point, which we heard has a lot of bushland and about a kilometre of beachfront. So it was just around 10 to 8 that night, and instead of turning into his street, Rajwinder Singh's blue Alfa Romeo appears to go straight to Flying Fish Point, and then it comes back and turns into the street about 8:45 at night. So there's almost an hour kind of down that road somewhere that isn't really explained, but we heard evidence from Sukhdeep Kaur, his wife, that she didn't hear him come home that night, and she typically went to bed around 8:30 each night.
Interesting. And Chris, you know, just kind of as the crow flies, or as you would normally drive it, how long does it take to get between, you know, Cairns and Innisfail to the south?
probably the time that it took him in the morning is about what you would expect. At the time, we heard evidence that there were no cameras between Gordon Vale and Innes Vale. So there's no way of knowing exactly, you know, where the extra time might have been added to his journey back to town. But interestingly, earlier in the drive home through Cairns as well, like there's a point at which we heard evidence that he's coming to a road where to go to Innes Vale, you'd turn right onto the main highway, and Rajwinder Singh's blue Alfa Romeo was actually seen heading straight. And he's gone down a road to the Cairns City Pound, where there's a kind of a channel of water, and CCTV footage kind of captured his car getting to a cul-de-sac area and turning around. So the Crown's kind of putting this evidence out there as evidence that he was driving near bodies of water on the way back home to Innes Vale that night. We saw that there was a kind of point at which he was captured driving into and out of Lake Placid in the suburb of Caravonica. I guess it's part of the Crown kind of building a picture of what his journey home was like. And again, we'll hear more about what conclusions both sides want us to draw from this evidence when each counsel closes the case.
Yeah. And I mean, we also heard in our previous episode, Chris, I think Thursday last week, we were talking about the police searching an area around Lake Placid as well and getting there and deciding not to send the divers in because of the crocodiles. So, look, thanks for kind of filling us in and giving us that picture of Rajwinder Singh's movements that evening and afternoon. As well as all that evidence, Chris, you know, we've seen Toya Cordingley's autopsy photos. These are some pretty full-on photos. And, you know, there was a warning given to the court before they were presented. And Toya Cordingley's parents, who've been in the room following proceedings since they've given evidence themselves, actually took that opportunity to leave the room. And also a heads up to you as well, just a content warning, we're going to be talking about the injuries that Toya Cordingley sustained on the beach. And, I mean, I was actually quite surprised by some of this evidence. It was really quite clinical, very unemotional, the delivery of evidence generally, but yet in this sense, you know, just the way that, you know, the forensic pathologist described what he was able to learn from the wounds that Toya Cordingley suffered on that beach, you know, the potential size of the blade used, you know, how long it could have taken Toya to die, all of those things. Chris, it is really full on though, having to listen to that, having to look at those photos. Why does the jury have to do that?
That's right, Stocky, and I guess there's no real sugarcoating it. The series of images is quite gruesome and really hard to look at, and there is one actually that stands out above all as being particularly tough to see. But I guess a lot of the conclusions that the prosecution and defence will want the jury to take away from these photos and the pathologist's findings will become clearer at the end of the trial when they're delivering their closing addresses. But we heard evidence from the forensic pathologist, Dr. Paul Bottrell, who went through each of the wounds kind of one by one and talked about defining features and things that he could conclude from them. A lot of things weren't necessarily conclusive, but things he felt were likely. For example, a lot of the questioning focused on perhaps the most severe wound, which was the one that he judged was most likely to have caused her death, which was this cut to her throat and her neck, which was delivered in about four motions. And Dr. Bottrell felt that was more likely to have been inflicted from behind, for example, rather than by an attacker in front. There was one wound, a stab wound to her chest that was about 85 millimetres deep, and Dr. Bottrell felt that particular wound gave the best indication of the size of the sharp object that was used to attack Toya accordingly. But he can't be exactly conclusive about whether it was a knife, exactly what type of knife it was, just that he felt that it was most likely to be a blade with a handle and that he didn't see any evidence of a serration. So a serrated blade didn't appear likely.
And we know in this case, Chris, that, you know, there was no knife recovered from the scene. The prosecution hasn't put forward a murder weapon or found a murder weapon in this case.
That's right. And Dr. Bottrell said with, you know, these type of measurements that you can glean from wounds, he said it's more useful in cases where you have a suspected murder weapon and you're trying to match it. But he said the difficulty is 90% of the knives in the world that people have are roughly the size of, you know, what we're looking at here. So he was able to draw some conclusions, and without going into too much detail, he was kind of talking about the extent of bleeding that Toya accordingly may have experienced and what that may have looked like at the scene. But some things were also left a little bit hard to definitively conclude from the autopsy findings.
Yeah, really confronting stuff, a really sort of stark reminder of, you know, the reason that we're talking about this trial, about the trial of Rajwinder Singh, you know, the death of a young woman, Toya accordingly, in 2018. So it's incredibly sad that we have to be here having that, but it's an insight into the process of, you know, finding out, you know, a bit about what happened there, you know, through this trial. Chris, we are getting a lot of questions sent to the pod still. thecaseofatabc.net.au is our email address. And you know, look, I'd love to jump into a few of them. I want to start with one here from Sasha. Sasha writes, "Hi, guys. Thanks for your hard work on the Case of podcast. Given Singh is saying he left the beach, then the country because he witnessed a murder, wouldn't he be expected to take the stand and explain his own actions?"
There's no requirement on any accused to take the stand to answer any questions. It's on the Crown and the prosecution to prove their case. In this case, we heard in the openings that there would be evidence shown to the court from a covert recording between Rajwinder Singh and an undercover police officer in a watch house cell. Certainly no onus on Rajwinder Singh or any accused to come and give evidence or an explanation of any of their actions in relation to the case.
Great question, Sasha. Thank you, Chris, for answering that one. Another one here from Melody. Chris, Melody writes, "Hi, Stocky and Chris. Been listening since day one of the Mushroom trial. I live in Cairns and remember Toya's murder investigation quite well. Question about Rajwinder Singh's phone. You mentioned there was no ping for 7 hours, possibly off or on airplane mode. Didn't his friend in his statement say he was scrolling his phone in the car on the way to the airport? Was this after the 7 hour window or during?"
Yeah, that's right. That was the next day. So that was the Monday, the 22nd of October, the day after Ms. Cordingley was murdered and when Rajwinder Singh was leaving Cairns. So the 7 hour gap in his phone records was from about 1:15 in the afternoon on the 21st. So that's the afternoon that all this has happened at Wongeti Beach. And then the next phone ping was around 8:15 later that evening. So kind of the afternoon, early evening part of the 21st of October, there's a gap in Rajwinder Singh's phone records. Investigators did obtain his phone records and have them for the following day. Interestingly, we saw on one of the CCTV shots yesterday, which was him at Cairns Airport, appearing to be on the phone at the time as he was entering the terminal building. And we heard evidence that he was actually calling a cousin, Gulal Singh, who lived in New South Wales. At the time, New South Wales police did speak to that cousin, but he didn't make a statement.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Chris. Melody, great question. Appreciate the opportunity to kind of clarify that. Lots of detail, lots of dates, lots of times. They're all in Chris Tester's head. So if there's anything you're not sure about, send us an email, thecaseof@abc.net.au. We really do love hearing from you. So please get in touch. Continue sending us all these questions. We really enjoy answering them. And it's a really helpful way to make sure that you're able to kind of follow along and engage in this case as much as possible. And while we're talking about engaging, one of the other things we're doing at the moment is we're running a little survey to learn a little bit more about how you listen to The Case Of and what you enjoy about the pod. The link for that is in the episode description for this episode, and I would love it if you could jump in and fill that out, only partly because the data from that will end up in a spreadsheet, and I enjoy spreadsheets, but really mostly because this pod is for you and really keen to hear how, you know, we can make it suit you and your preferences even more. I want to learn about the kind of coverage that you would like us to be doing, live trials like this, post-trial analysis, recaps of other proceedings. If you'd like video versions, if you would like The Case Of merch, there's lots of things we're really keen to learn. And if you jump into the link in the show notes, in the app description, you'll be able to help us learn that. So please do that. While you're doing that, while you're jumping in the show notes, Chris Tester, what have we got coming up? Where are we going?
We're starting to hear evidence about some of the other people who came to police attention during this investigation. So we've heard a little bit of evidence from a man named Remy Fry, who was visiting his mother at Wongeti Beach that afternoon, and kind of some of the questions that police asked of him. during their investigation kind of towards the latter part of October 2018. I expect we'll start to hear a little bit more about where these kind of witnesses fit in to the broader picture as we complete the puzzle of how the police investigation into Toye Cordingley's murder unfolded.
Yeah, and we did have this set down as a 3-week trial. We were expecting it to be about 3 weeks. We're at the start of the third week. Is that timing looking about right, or are we going to go a bit longer, do you think?
It's always hard to know with trials, you do, without a clear indication from counsel on both sides. I'm not sure, but I think we will certainly have a busy week ahead of us this week.
Thank you, Chris. Very diplomatic answer for something that hasn't been put before the jury. So appreciate your insight. We'll be back in your feed on Thursday with all the latest details from the case of Toye's murder. The Case of Toye's Murder is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by Chris Tester and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. This episode was produced on the land of the Gimoi, Wallabara, Yidinji and Wurundjeri people.